Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday morning. Last night, Wisconsin's Paul Ryan delivered a lengthy speech at the Republican National Convention. Also, Condoleezza Rice, former Secretary of State, Mike Huckabee spoke. Governor Martinez from New Mexico also spoke. We'll have two guests with us the first hour. We'll listen to what some of the speakers had to say in case you missed it. Joining us the first part of the hour, Philip Klein, senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner and author of Conservative Survival in the Romney Era. He wrote this response to the Ryan address last night. He said it was scathing in its criticism of Obama's policies without being personally nasty. It was intelligent without getting too wonky. It portrayed our nation's current situation as grim while making a positive case that things can be better. And after weeks of attacks trying to paint Ryan as a radical, the speech was very humanizing and perhaps even slightly humorous.
The issue is not the economy that Barack Obama inherited, not the economy that he envisions, but this economy that we are living. College graduates should not have to live out their 20s in their childhood bedrooms, staring up at fading Obama posters and wondering when they can move out and get going with life.
We'll be welcoming your phone calls during this hour as well. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Philip Klein, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Will there be college students who listen to that line, which I thought was very effective, and consider the Republican ticket? Are there Republican young people? Will there be more of them in this election who will vote Republican?
I think so. I mean, clearly I think that, you know, Obama's still likely to do better among younger voters because younger voters tend to be more Democratic. However, if the Romney-Ryan ticket could narrow the gap, then that could be helpful. They don't need to win because Republicans tend to do better with older voters. They don't need to win younger voters. They just need to narrow the gap between them and Obama. And I think that a lot of the speech was sort of directed at them in the sense that what was smart about Ryan's speech and why I thought it was a very effective critique of President Obama is that it didn't try to make the maximalist criticism of President Obama, which is to try to blame him for literally everything that's wrong in America. Because a lot of Americans, as even Ryan acknowledged, understand that President Obama inherited a tough situation. The economy was bad when he took it over. So even though Americans aren't willing to blame Obama for everything, one thing that virtually everyone would agree on, unless they're a partisan Democrat, is that He fell far short of his promise that in, 2008 we had the excitement of hope and change, of things just transforming and a new era beginning in America, a change in the tone of politics. And after 4 years, nobody can say that that happened. I mean, there are a lot of liberals who are disappointed that Obama didn't live up to his promises, even though they think that he may have done the best with the hand he was dealt. So I think that's a much narrower argument that's easier to sell, and I think it's particularly true that a lot of young people, put their hopes in President Obama more than any other generation, and a lot of them are out of work. And I think that, that was a very effective point and a way of making an argument to Obama that's not just preaching to the choir.
We know him well because we live in Wisconsin. was trying to imagine myself being a person from another state who didn't know him very well at all. And there were many people in America who were listening to him last night from that perspective. He had this task of introducing himself, of outlining policies, Obama policies where he didn't live up to his promise. He also had the task of really giving enthusiastic support for Mitt Romney. Did he live up to all of those? First of all, did we know him much better if we didn't know him as a result of this? And did he really sing the praises of Mitt Romney as he needed to do last night?
Well, first of all, you know, like you, I, you know, have known Paul Ryan for a long time. So, again, it's harder for me to analyze how it would the average voter would perceive it. And also, I was on the floor for the speech. I wasn't watching on TV, so I don't know how it was sort of coming across on TV. That having been said, my hunch is that I think he did a good job of introducing himself. I found it, as I wrote, a very humanizing speech, particularly when he talked about his mom and, you know, what she did to sort of, after her, she became a 50-year-old widow, you know, taking a long 40-mile bus ride into Madison to try to, you know, go to school and then, you know, working hard to start a small business and spoke of her being his role model. I thought, you know, just even touches about sort of him and, you know, the difference, you know, in terms of Romney, the touches about, for instance, how they have different music on their iPods and, you know, come from a different, you know, generation, I thought was a nice touch. And I thought he did try to make the, you know, the case that, you know, for Romney and for why his private sector experience could be helpful in terms of turning this thing around. And I think what's important too is I've, you know, been covering Ryan for a number of years, and one of the things that you know, some people have criticized him for, you know, in the past is that he seemed somehow to be, you know, dour and a downer because he talked about the nation's crushing debt burden and how we're going to, you know, sleepwalking down off of a fiscal cliff and so forth. But this time I thought that he emphasized the positive more. In other words, it doesn't have to be this way. We can do it better. We're running out of time, so we could fix things if we change the policies. So I thought that was effective.
Let's talk a little bit about Medicare. It would appear to me that Medicare is going to be now front and center in this campaign. Let's listen to what he had to say, and then we have a few questions for you about Medicare and why the Republicans have decided to take this issue on. This is Paul Ryan during last night's address.
Even with all the hidden taxes to pay for the health care takeover, even with the new law and new taxes on nearly a million small businesses, the planners in Washington still didn't have enough money. They needed more. They needed hundreds of billions more. So they just took it all away from Medicare. $716 billion funneled out of Medicare by President Obama. An obligation we have to our parents and grandparents is being sacrificed, all to pay for a new entitlement we didn't even ask for.
Philip, the Democrats will charge that Paul Ryan's plan also cut $716 billion from Medicare.
Yeah, here's the reality. President Obama's plan, first of all, the idea was that Obamacare spends a lot more money by expanding Medicaid, and the other thing is setting up these health insurance exchanges and then, you know, giving people subsidies to purchase health insurance on these government health exchanges. That costs about $1.7 trillion, and there's only about $1 trillion of tax increases in that to cover that. So, as Paul Ryan said, the rest had to be made up for by finding savings in Medicare. And Democrats will try to say that the Medicare cuts within Obamacare just come to providers like hospitals and, you know, and nursing facilities and so forth. However, what the chief actuary of the Medicare program has said is that when you cut, you know, payments to providers, a lot of providers are simply going to not take Medicare anymore. So that even if on paper a lot of seniors say that their Medicare benefits cover something, they're going to find that there are fewer places where they can get care, and that's just the reality. You can't cut the payments to hospitals without cutting, ultimately affecting benefits. Now, in terms of Ryan's budget, this sort of gets into a sort of tricky budget way, you know, way budgets are accounted for in Washington, D.C., and that's basically that something is used called baseline budgeting, which essentially means that any budget that you put out has to be measured against some sort of yardstick that is determined by the Congressional Budget Office. And the Congressional Budget Office assumes that anything that's current law gets implemented. So as a result of that, when Ryan wrote his budget, Obamacare was the law of the land. And as a result of that, when you look at the level that Medicare came at, it assumed that Obama's Medicare cuts came into place. That was in the law, that's in the baseline. So while it's true that, you know, Paul Ryan assumed those cuts in his budget, he was just, you know, maintaining what the CBO baseline was. And the difference also between the two is that Ryan's budget decreases spending in other areas and basically makes tweaks to the long-term health of Medicare, whereas Obama, so essentially Ryan uses that to shore up the Medicare program to try to bring down the long-term debt trajectory, whereas Obama used this to create a new entitlement. So one way of saying it is that in Ryan's, but even though they both include these cuts, in the Ryan, in the Obama budget, spending on Obamacare exchanges and the Medicaid expansion is trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars over time, whereas that money is zeroed out under the Ryan plan.
It would just briefly, because we have a ton of phone calls, but isn't there a fundamental change in Medicare in the plan that will have to be sold by the Republicans because it changes the program? Seniors will be given money. Some have complained that it won't keep up with the cost of rising cost of health care for them to go on the market and get insurance themselves. That's a fundamental change in Medicare.
Well, I don't think it's not quite right to say they have to go on the market to get health care themselves. The reality is that first of all, what we know is that the current Medicare plan is unsustainable. The current Medicare plan will not be there for my generation or my 30s. It won't exist because there's just not enough spending for it. What Ryan's plan would do would be to give people a choice. They could stay in traditional Medicare if they wanted, but they could also take their money and purchase another plan that would have to be, you know, meet certain criteria set by the government. So it's not as if you just give the government, you know, seniors money and they just have to hope that someone will take them or accept them or so forth. I mean, that there'll be a set up exchange that people can purchase health care on. And the idea is, and hopefully with broader health care reforms, that if you bring more choice and competition, it'll actually drive down costs in that way.
Philip Klein, our guest, senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner, author of Conservative Survival in the Romney Era. He's our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk about last night's addresses before the Republican National Convention, with particular emphasis on Paul Ryan, although we will during this hour hear some of what Condoleezza Rice had to say in a much admired speech. People from both sides of the aisle really praised her comments last night, and we'll listen to Mike Huckabee talking a great deal about religion, which is interesting as we move into tonight's keynote address from Mitt Romney and this whole issue of conservative evangelical voters, whether or not they can embrace Mitt Romney. Did Mike Huckabee make that case last night? Two phone calls. Let's start with Joan in Williams Bay. Hi, Joan.
Oh, hi. Good morning. The convention should put Paul Ryan's name in the hat for president. He fills the bill. He's brilliant. He makes sense. He's leadership. He'll be able to deal with the world stage, I believe. He's lucid. He's good on women's issue. I mean, for women. I hope they can do that. He has my vote.
Philip.
Well, obviously, you know, it's not going to happen this time around, but I think that if Mitt Romney loses in November, I believe that, you know, Ryan could be a top contender in 2016, and if Romney and Ryan serve two terms, then he'd obviously be next in line in, 2020.
Thanks, Joan, for your call. Jill in New Berlin. Hi, Jill.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have the opposite view, I guess, of Ryan's speech last night. There's an article on the Yahoo homepage this morning going statement by statement and fact-checking him and showing how duplicitous this whole speech was. Basically, the same money, despite what your guest said, is taken out of Medicare in Ryan's plan, and it's being taken away from people's services rather than the insurance companies like Obama's plan would. Ryan tells that he's, you know, going to cut the deficit, but under the Ryan budget, the balance isn't even budgeted till the year 2030. Statements that he made about Obama are provably untrue. Statements about the GM plant in Janesville, for example, which was closed before Obama even took office. He claims that he promised to save it. He did save the auto industry, but Janesville was closed before Obama even took office.
All right. Your phone is a little bit shady here, so let me start with the comments about the budget. The Ryan plan, the budget has been criticized, and we'll hear more of this as the campaign goes on, of course, Philip, as being too harsh, as cutting programs from the less fortunate in this country.
Well, the thing is that the idea that Paul Ryan has is that right now the Medicaid program, even though it's sort of the state-federal partnership, it doesn't encourage states to try to innovate to save money. So the idea is that if instead of designing the program at the federal level and having states, have to work within a very constrained system, it's saying let's give the states a block grant and we'll give you a certain amount of money, and then you figure out the best way to create savings. Maybe it's by encouraging generic drugs or encouraging HMOs, or there are different reform factors that could be experimented at the state level if there was more flexibility. On the other issue about the Ryan plan not balancing the budget till 2030, first of all, No Obama budget ever balances the budget, ever, in 80 years. I mean, there's no budget balance. So that's number one. Secondly, the deficit is severely goes down under, it starts, the annual deficits start to go down at the end of the decade under Ryan's plan. Also, the important thing to keep in mind is that, the bottom line of why we need to get our debt under control is that we want to make sure that our credit is still good so that bondholders will still purchase U.S. Treasury bonds and we can continue to borrow money. And as anyone, you know, with a credit card knows or with a mortgage payment, you could get a loan as long as the, you know, the person lending the money is confident that you're going to be able to pay over the long term. And that's all that bondholders care about. If they know that there's a plan that is going to balance the budget, even if it takes 20 years, if they know there's a plan in place, then they're going to be much more confident investing in a 30-year treasury bond than if no plan is in place. So that's the important thing to do, is to bring down this long-term trajectory. And that's what the Ryan plan does, and Obama's plan does not. And you don't have to just take it to me. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner even testified before the Budget Committee that we don't have a long-term plan.
Let's listen to his comments about the Janesville plant, because it created quite a stir yesterday, and it will be something that we'll hear about more, and I'm sure from commentators who were critical of the speech. But let's get your response to it. This is what Paul Ryan said last night on the closing of that Janesville plant.
Right there at that plant, candidate Obama said, "I believe that if our government is there to support you, this plant will be here for another 100 years." That's what he said in 2008. Well, as it turned out, that plant didn't last another year. It is locked up and empty to this day.
Your response to the criticism that that plant had closed in 2008, that there are people who are very critical.
Well, first of all, that's not quite true, because what had happened is that the plant was idle. And it started to be idle for some cars in 2008, and then it started to be completely idle in 2009. And what GM had said would be that if economic conditions improved, that they'd reopen it, and they've never reopened it. So, again, I think that this also gets to the point that I was making earlier, is that even if you don't blame Obama for everything and saying that he wasn't, you know, he's to blame for the plant, you know, having to idle in the first place. The reality is that he said in Janesville, "I believe if our," you know, this is a direct quote, this is the Fuller quote, "I believe that if our government is there to support you and give you the assistance you need to retool and make this transition, that this plant will be here for another 100 years." And the idea is this gets back to the point of Obama overpromising and under-delivering, and that's the key point, is that Obama said it would be open for 100 years if he were elected and his policies were implemented, and it is not.
Let's go to Mike Huckabee last night. One of the other things that has been discussed is evangelical Christians and whether or not they will warm to Mitt Romney and vote for Mitt Romney, that there may be a problem there. Mike Huckabee made the case last night that they should. Let's listen to him, your response, and then we'll let you go back to that floor. Here's Mike Huckabee last night.
I want to clear the air about something that has been said. People wonder whether guys like me, an evangelical, would only support a fellow evangelical. Well, my friends, I want to tell you something. Of the four people on the two tickets, the only self-professed evangelical is Barack Obama. And he supports changing the definition of marriage, believes that human life is disposable and expendable at any time in the womb, even beyond the womb. And he tells people of faith that they have to bow their knees to the God of government and violate their faith and conscience in order to comply with what he calls health care. Friends, I know we can do better.
I happen to think that Mike Huckabee is a very effective speaker, Philip.
No, I agree, and I thought that was an effective way for, you know, obviously Mike Huckabee has a very strong connection with evangelical voters.
Yes.
And I thought that was a very deft way of trying to essentially make the case that, you know, look, you know, to people who just have problems voting for a Mormon, you know, look, Obama is an evangelical and look at all, you know, and all the issues that are near to dear to you, he's on the wrong side. So essentially in elective office, you shouldn't, you know, consider religion. I thought that was, you know, a very important moment and, you know, it was very sort of inclusive language, I thought.
Mm-hmm. All right, tonight's the big night. Mitt Romney will be speaking tonight. What does he need to do? So many people have said, I wonder, we just keep repeating ourselves, he's got to warm up. Jeb Bush was saying he's got to connect with an audience. He's got to be human in some way. We've spent a good portion of this week asking whether or not his wife's speech made him more human. It seems to me as though that's one of his tasks. I'm not sure how he accomplishes that, how what is meant by connecting with the audience. But he's got a big speech tonight. He's got to come across as a little warmer, do you think? As he really has to get people excited, or are they already there after this week? They're excited and ready to go.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the main thing is that he has to sort of, yeah, I mean, ideally he sort of humanizes himself in some way. That might be a difficult hurdle just because he's kind of an awkward guy. And, you know, I mean, how many times did they say the same thing about, you know, Gore or the first President Bush or so forth, that they have to humanize themselves and so forth? Some politicians are just naturally kind of uncomfortable being themselves and so forth. So anything that he could do towards that is definitely would be beneficial if he comes across as likable and earnest. Then I think that you know, that would help. But I think that's more important is I think he has to think that why he has a plan, why he has to convince people that he can make things better. There are a lot of voters who, you know, think things are lousy, but they're just not sure if Romney could make them any better. They're almost so cynical with hearing so many promises every 4 years from different presidential candidates that they don't think that anything can actually change. And so I think that that's an important point. He has to sort of outline his plans to get, you know, why he's, you know, why things would change.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I think that Paul Ryan did a good job of critiquing Obama. I think the task falls to Romney to convincing him, mm-hmm. you know, to filling in more in terms of why things don't have to be this way.
So to understand Paul Ryan, do we need to listen to AC/DC?
You know, I don't know. I think that was smart, again, when we were talking about appealing to the youth vote, to, you know, have this reference to, you know, the iPad and so forth. I mean, Paul, especially the sort of Gen X generation.
Right.
So.
It just makes me wonder what Mitt Romney likes to listen to, too, but I guess we'll find out in the upcoming days.
Yeah.
Philip, thank you very much. You'll be on the floor tonight, I'm sure.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks. Philip Klein, senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner, author of Conservative Survival in the Romney Era. We're switching guests. We're still focusing our attention on last night's speeches, particularly the one from Wisconsin, Congressman Paul Ryan, but we're also looking at, we have yet to listen to Condoleezza Rice. She gave an effective speech last night. Many were saying we'll talk about that and look a little bit at foreign policy, which is a big part of an American presidential administration, and what we have learned so far about what course Republicans would take and what Mitt Romney may say about that during this evening's address. Lenny McAllister is joining us. Lenny is an author and a conservative commentator. His books include Diary of a Mad Black PYC, which stands for Proud Young Conservative, and also Spoken Thoughts from an Amalgamated Advocate in Today's America. We'll be welcoming your phone calls again, as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the next hour of our program today, Joan Walsh will be joining us. Her new book has the provocative title, What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age that never was. Joan is also at the Republican National Convention. She's editor-at-large of Salon and an MSNBC political analyst. She's a graduate. I love all these people who have connections to Wisconsin. She's a graduate of UW-Madison and went to Shorewood High School as well, so she will be with us. And Lenny is with us now, Lenny McAllister, author and conservative commentator. Lenny, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. And, you know, I have a Wisconsin connection as well. When I first moved into Chicagoland a couple of years ago, I stayed in Kenosha. And I actually would stay with family in Kenosha, and I made the trip down to the south side of Chicago. So, in essence, I was learning to be a resident in two communities and learning about two wonderful communities. And the only very harmful thing about living in Wisconsin was the fact that that was the year when my beloved Pittsburgh Steelers lost to those Green Bay Packers in the Super Bowl.
Ah, those Green Bay Packers. Those Green Bay Packers. They're loved here, of course, as you know. Lenny, let me just ask you, you are a young African-American. Much has been said of the fact that the Romney-Ryan ticket is not going to receive a lot of African-American votes this go-around, and that Obama received a huge number of African-American votes last go-around. What has attracted you to the Republican Party? Why are you not a Democrat?
I think that the principles of the Republican Party have a sense of attractiveness to African Americans. I think that it's been the candidates and some of the high-profile gaffes that have pushed black folks towards the Democratic Party. Now, for me, I see myself as an advocate and as a trailblazer, somebody that provides an opportunity for African Americans to look at those Republican principles, values, and policies, while at the same time changing the culture within the conservative movement to be more amenable to allowing more minorities in the 21st century to not only be part of the party, but to be leaders in the party.
You have said that the choice of Paul Ryan was, and I quote you, probably the best choice that Governor Romney could have taken for several reasons. What are those reasons?
I think, number one, he gets an opportunity to pick somebody that has a good amount of experience at the federal level. This is a seven-term congressman. He's seen an economic walk. He is still under the age of 45. He is somebody that has a relatable life story. I mean, again, his dad was an attorney, but his late father, and he passed away when he was in his teens, as somebody that had to work his way through college. And there's enough relatability from being from a Midwestern state, still being a Generation Xer, still getting the youth on his side, and somebody that can speak to the economic issues from a federal level with a deep amount of acumen that would allow the Romney-Ryan ticket at this point to be able to connect to several sectors. If he goes with Marco Rubio, he gets the swing state of Florida, perhaps. He gets the young vote, perhaps. If he goes with somebody like a Rob Portman, he perhaps gets Ohio, perhaps gets establishment Republicans behind him. But by picking this election, he has the best opportunity to hit several different demographics successfully if they play their cards right on the campaign trail.
He gave an effective line last night, which we've already played, about those 20-somethings who may be still living at their parents' homes and they have a faded Obama poster that's fallen off the ceiling because and the promises haven't gone anywhere. Does this ticket need to attract those voters? Are there many of them? And do they stand a chance of attracting those voters?
You know, a lot of those voters are folks that have their homes upside down in Florida. A lot of those voters are folks that have lost their jobs, the good-paying technical jobs that they first had coming out of college that aren't there anymore. They need those voters for two reasons. Number one, they need them to vote for the Romney-Ryan ticket, and they're going to need those voters to be taxpayers once again in order to get America out of the economic crisis that we have right now. They're going to have to be able to tell Generation X, you are the new leaders of this country. You are the hope of this country, and we need you to get behind us so that we can rebuild this country. We know that older voters will probably lean towards Governor Romney. We know that most minority demographics are going to go behind President Obama. It's Generation X and those baby boomers, the younger baby boomers. That those are two interesting groups that the Romney-Ryan ticket, if they can get them and perhaps their spouses to go for Romney-Ryan, they'll find the win within those numbers.
The Republican Party is a party that has been criticized for being overwhelmingly white. Considering the changing demographics in this country, the number of minorities who will soon become majorities in the country, it would behoove, many have said, the Republican Party to reach out to minorities. Have they been negligent in doing that? Do they have to do that in order to survive, and how should they do that?
They have been negligent in doing that. They have not done that as successfully as they need to. I know that former Chairman Michael Steele did an effective job of doing that the first 2 years he was there, and as a result, you saw an upswell in 2010 of Latino and African-American candidates not only running for office, but winning offices. But moving forward, we have to have more than just candidates going into office. We have to have policies that make sense for African Americans and for urban Americans at the local level, at the state level, so that we can have candidates there as well, and not just candidates, but leaders, both in elected office as well as in volunteer offices, on advisory boards, things along those lines. That's how the Republican Party is going to make true traction with urban Republicans, urban Americans, whether they be African-American, Latino, or white Americans.
Let's welcome phone calls again. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. You can leave messages, and we're interested in all those messages. Many of us are watching the conventions, and we'll do the Democrats next week, don't worry. But we're watching them very, very closely because it's the future of our country and because we love to watch them. So we're interested in your comments on Facebook as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. What did you think of Paul Ryan, Mike Huckabee, Condoleezza Rice, Governor Martinez from New Mexico, all of whom spoke last night? We want to hear your responses. Here's an email that has come in from Bill, who writes, if Republicans take the White House and if Democrats controlling the Senate act the same way Republicans in the House have until now, how will electing Romney change anything?
A different sort of bipartisan tone. I think that the House of Representatives has learned through the debt ceiling crisis that we cannot allow the extreme ends of our government, whether it was with the Democrats during the health care reform situation in 2010 or the debt ceiling crisis with the Tea Party in 2011. We can't let the extremes run rampant. I think Governor Romney at least has executive experience in government, ruling over a party, if you will, looking at the General Assembly up in Massachusetts, that leaned away from him from a partisan sense. I think that we'll have a different sort of methodology to engage the other side. I think they're going to try to put some barriers in place, but I think that there'll be a better opportunity to go after some of the things that we need in America in order to move the country forward in a way that may not be as drastic or as radical coming out of the gate as we saw from the Democrats and President Obama in 2009 and moving into 2010.
Let's go to calls. Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. I'd like to ask the guest what his opinion is in all the speeches at the convention in which President Obama's leadership has been denied, rejected, and so forth. Why are they not giving Senator McConnell credit for what the Republicans swore to do 4 years ago, that they would never let President Obama achieve anything in order to discredit him and so that he would not ever get reelected? What they are criticizing what they set out to do. They should take credit for having prevented a serious economic recovery, though it's not as bad as they're saying it is, et cetera, et cetera.
I think, number one, sir, and thank you for your question, number one, we have to remember that Mitch McConnell said that 2011 after the Republicans took over the House of Representatives, because in 2009 the Republicans couldn't do much of anything to stop President Obama. The Democrats had a huge majority in the House of Representatives, and they were on their way to having a filibuster-proof Senate after Arlen Specter switched over to the Democratic Party and Al Franken was confirmed as the winner of the race up in Minnesota. So the Republicans did not have much power to keep him to being a one-term president. With that said, though, this is the same type of partisan tone that we have seen from minority groups in Congress and on Capitol Hill for decades now. I think that when it comes to this recovery, if you really look at the numbers, it's not being overblown or blown out of proportion. Some of the numbers are unreported. For example, the unemployment rate in the African American community is officially at 14%, but some unofficial numbers go as high as 25%. And if you look at African American youth that are unemployed, some of those go over 50% in certain areas of the United States. So if anything, I think some of the situations in regard to the level of crisis that we're facing are underreported. Now, with that said, though, do I think that the Republicans are taking the best strategy in regards to going after President Obama and making him a one-term president? No. The best strategy that they had used so far, and it showed this in the polls, was to say this is a nice guy, but he's just not up to it. He's tried. He didn't cut it. We need another president, versus the personal attacks that were seemingly going back towards moving forward with this campaign.
Let's talk a little bit more about African-American unemployment, which has been very high for a long time. It's at a sinfully high level, I think. What is it that, I don't think either party is addressing this issue very well. Is there something that makes you believe that the Republicans can take this on in a much better way than the Democrats? And I guess the other question is, why hasn't anybody taken it on in a very serious fashion?
Well, the sad thing is, in regards to black unemployment, the reason why it hasn't been taken on in a very serious fashion is because the Democrats count on the black vote and Republicans count on not getting the black vote. So it's already baked into the political cake when elections come around, so nobody has to compete for those constituents in order to get some kind of responsiveness at the voting booth and once they get into office. So they're taken for granted. Now, in regards to the high levels of unemployment, I do think that the Republican Party, the party that is more inclined to be pro-business in our political climate more often than not, has the tool, if applied properly, and I emphasize, if applied properly, they have the tools that can bring business into at-need neighborhoods, that can get people back to work, that can improve the tax base, which will improve the schools, which will improve the quality of citizenry in those neighborhoods, and thus allow those neighborhoods to rise up. But again, if applied properly, and that's one of the things that I try to do as a black Republican, ensure that those things are applied properly.
Kurt, thanks for the call. Dave in Wanakee, hi.
Yes, I think your guest wasn't being entirely ingenuous when he compared Obamacare, the passage of Obamacare, as being something that was led by the extremes of the party, to the budget fight where Republicans prevented legislation from passing using the extremes of the party. The party that is led by the extreme, the one with the tail wagging the dog, is the Republican Party, and it's apparent to everyone in this country.
Lenny.
Well, sir, I'd have to reply this way. If we look at the political Olympic maneuvers that transpired in order to get that vote passed, where the conservative Democrats had to be bought off, you're looking at things such as the Cornhusker kickback and Gatorade and the Louisiana Purchase. Those things had to be put into place. Deals that were made by Nancy Pelosi, who is not a moderate by any stretch of the imagination. She was pulling the strings to get the conservative Democrats to fly over to her end of seeing things in order to get that vote through the House of Representatives and make sure that they could do the same thing in the Senate when it came to Harry Reid making those same deals. And ironically enough, as it continued to shift to the left, if you remember, what was the thing that made it go through? Remember, Bart Stupak was holding out. Bart Stupak had to make a deal, or President Obama had to make a deal through executive order in order to bring last contingency of conservative Democrats over to the far left wing of the Democratic Party in order to push through the Affordable Care Act in a way that circumvented traditional congressional and senatorial processes to get a bill passed. That is extreme to get one of the most controversial pieces of legislation ever passed in the history of the United States.
Well, Lenny, let's take on the issue. It doesn't have to be health care, but people have had it, I think, with everybody in Washington. The polls reflect that. Congress has this abysmally low approval rating. We have done in the past 3 years, I can't tell you how many shows on health care, where Republicans and Democrats and people in health care and people who are uninsured and people who are in the industry have gathered at the table and said, this, something needs to happen with this system. And we count on people in Washington to make things better, to come up with a plan that will make things better for human beings who are suffering as a result of high costs, not being insured, etc. Why the heck can't both parties get together on some of these important issues and do something instead of trying to say something is maneuvered backhand or get rid of a particular piece of legislation? Why can't they address what is obviously a serious problem?
Because the politicians love power more than they love the people that they're there to serve, and because the people love voting in popular people versus voting in leaders. Leadership in politics is not supposed to be glamorous in a Hollywood sense. It's supposed to be honorable in a historic sense. And unfortunately, as an American people collectively, we have forgotten that. We vote politicians in the office, not statesmen. We vote greedy people in the office in some regards, not humble servant leaders. We need to start getting back to a better model of civics where we honor each other through our debate and disagreement, and we elect individuals that we know truly want to serve. Sometimes, you know, I sit here and I think we need to put term limits in for all offices. We shouldn't have people in Congress for 40 years. We shouldn't have senators in office for 36 years, as was the case with Vice President Biden before he became the vice president. We need people that remember at all times that they are there to serve, as you said, human beings in need. They're there to be smart, talented, humble servant leaders. And I think that once we start shifting that focus back, we'll get to a point of time where people will no longer think that compromise is a dirty word. They'll understand that politics is about uncomfortable disagreements and debates, and we'll get to a point of resolutions that please both sides, that will be flexible enough for both sides to allow our diverse nation to be stronger as a result.
I think you just made yourself a candidate for something. Let's welcome phone calls. More of them in a moment. Lenny McAllister, author and conservative commentator. His books include Diary of a Mad Black, PYC, Proud Young Conservative, and others. He is at the convention in Tampa. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Tim in La Crosse next. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just in regards to that last call, I just wanted to say that it was the leadership of the Democratic Party that said that the infamous, we have to pass the bill to see what's in the bill. But I wanted to ask the guest about this person that's supposed to be the secret. They're being very tight-lipped about who's going to introduce Romney tonight. I've heard rumors that it could potentially be a Tim Tebow or a Clint Eastwood, but I personally, as a Tea Party conservative, I'd love to see Alan West. I haven't seen him at all. I don't know if maybe he spoke earlier in the week, but every time I see that guy, I just love what he has to say.
I think that Tebow would be interesting, but he'll stay out of politics, even though this is his home state. I can see Congressman West doing that. I actually saw Congressman West a little while ago. I saw him, and I also saw Lieutenant Governor Jennifer Carroll. I think that both of them are eloquent speakers. I think that Alan West, who is in a reelection bid right now here in Florida after being redistricted out of his previous district, but he's also a Tea Party favorite, and he is somebody that everybody knows. He is a polarizing figure, but he is also a lightning rod to get people excited. If Congressman West, who, I just saw him this week at a luncheon for Republicans here in Tampa, if he gets up there and gives a six-minute speech in introducing Governor Romney. One, Governor Romney is going to have a tough act to follow. But number two, people will be fired up either way, and I think that it will be most effective. I think they're going to go for the big celebrity in that regard, but I think from a political standpoint, as far as firing people up, don't be surprised if it's Congressman West.
Have you seen Clint Eastwood at breakfast anywhere?
I have not, but there have been plenty of sightings of different actors and entertainers. So it can be a slew of any one sort of people. But trust me, there are so many black cars with tinted windows around here in secrecy.
You'd
be amazed. You'd be looking for the Hollywood sign somewhere in the hills of Tampa if there were any.
And finally, we don't have a whole lot of time. This from Morgan. How do you rectify the Republican position on interracial marriage 40 years ago and the Republican position on gay marriage today?
I don't rectify the position from the conservative movement, which include both Republicans and Democrats from 40 and 50 years ago, because we're in 2012. And when it comes to gay marriage, I understand that as a Christian conservative, I want protection for the institution of traditional marriage, but I also understand the need and the right of gay couples to have protection under the Constitution for the union. Thus, I support civil unions. There are plenty of conservatives and Republicans that do support civil unions, while as Christian conservatives want to make sure that traditional marriage between one man and one woman at one time stays protected and honored in our society.
Finally, what does Mitt Romney have to do tonight to gather a whole lot of support in the country?
Mitt Romney has to talk to America, not just the delegation floor. He has to talk to America and tell them, I may not be able to relate to your personal story, and I may not have grown up like you, but we're on the same team. I may be the quarterback, you may be the wide receiver, but without you, I can't pass the ball and score the touchdown we need to win this game. So let's work together, get this political football over the goal line, and make it happen.
Lenny, thank you. Join us again, please.
God bless you all. Thank you.
Lenny McAllister, author and conservative commentator. His books include Diary of a Mad Black Proud Young Conservative. We also thank Philip Klein. Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers produced this program. We have news coming up, and Joan Walsh is with us the second hour of the program. I'm an old woman, so I got to tell you, I didn't know a lot about AC/DC, but I have to figure there are people in the audience who are with me who come from the Bob Dylan era. So I thought we would go out with a little bit of Paul Ryan's first on his iPod, AC/DC. Yeah,